It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
Good evening. You are listening to Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is Mind Your Business. If this voice is not familiar, it's because the regular host, Yitzhak Saflis, has inexplicably given me the microphone tonight. My name is Bill O'Reilly. I'm a friend of Yitzhak's, and have been fortunate to guest host Mind Your Business a few times over the years. Yitzhak is one of a kind. I've got to give a plug because we're getting into the holiday season. Yitzhak would never do this himself because he's far too modest. But he has a book out, which is just extraordinary. You can get it on Amazon, or you can get it on Barnes & Noble or any of the sites, called So What's the Bottom Line? It's 76 Tips for Marketing and PR for Any New Business. And it's really an incredible read. It's actually enjoyable. Again, it's called So What's the Bottom Line? A wonderful book by Yitzhak, who never plugs himself. He plugs everybody in the world, but not himself. But I'm very fortunate tonight to, we have a great guest with us and going to be a co-host with me named Liz Feld. Hello, Liz. How are you tonight?
Great, Billy. Thanks for having me. It's a treat to be here. You and I have done other media before, but I've never been on this show, and I'm grateful for the opportunity and the platform. So thanks to Yitzhak.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, he's really nice to give us the chance. And I think we're going to talk about a couple of topics, and then we're going to have a really interesting guest or guests on later on that are defying the trend of human civilization in a new business. Defying the trend with, of all things, paper, but we'll get there. Liz, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself? You've had a really interesting career. You were at ABC News, Nickelodeon. You were president of Autism Speaks, and now the Susan B. Wright Pancreatic Cancer Foundation. But can you talk a little bit about your background? Why don't we start with Washington?
Oh, yeah, I love Washington, D.C. I mean, I don't care what's going on politically. I have to tell you, I think it's one of these cities that's improved dramatically over the last 25, 30 years. I went to Georgetown back in the early 80s, and I did work in the Reagan administration for almost 4 years. First at the Office of Management and Budget, and I know we're going to be talking a lot about business tonight. And then I went on to work for Marlon Fitzwater, who at the time was press secretary for then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. It was extraordinary. It was fabulous. And being in Washington, as I said, it's an experience to treasure really for your whole life. And I did that. And I love it. Listen, I grew up in New York, and I'm a New Yorker, even though I've lived in a lot of other places. But my first experience in politics, like yours, was actually going door to door with my own father. Back, I was 5, 6, 8 years old doing local politics and then campaigning for people I've never heard of since.
He was mayor of Largemont, New York, wasn't he? At one point. I left that out of your resume.
No. He was the mayor. He was actually, a practicing attorney full time here in New York, doing a lot of aviation defense work. But he was very involved in local politics and ultimately became the mayor. And my mom was on the school board. I mean, my parents were very involved in every little thing, sometimes too involved. Not as helicopter parents, but just, in a small town. But it really was their example that got me engaged.
You're back at ABC because you were ABC for some time. You did communications, I guess.
I did communication. Yeah. I was not on the exciting side of the business. I certainly wasn't on the editorial side, which I always regretted. And I was so envious of all the people who were. Rune Arledge was the president of ABC News at the time.
It
was
legendary.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, legendary.
So I was more responsible for answering questions about why we were airing, hostage footage on the network, sort of standards and practices stuff, policies and public relations. And it was great. It was early 90s when all those big anchors were very high profile. And also then, it was before cable, other than CNN. So it was just three big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS for the most part. And it was another great experience.
And then how did you get, because I know you were at Nickelodeon as well, and then you started to move on to kind of helping in the healthcare business a little bit, or mental health, healthcare, like you became president of Autism Speaks. How did that, and you were mayor in between there, how did that transition occur?
Well, it's so interesting. Talk about coming full circle. Bob Wright, who was the chairman of NBC Universal for over 20 years and the vice chairman of GE, had a grandson who was diagnosed with autism back in early 2002. And he and his wife, his late wife, Suzanne Wright, founded Autism Speaks. They actually rolled up a couple of other autism organizations that were around the country doing very good work, some in the science space, some in advocacy, some just raising awareness. And they started this incredible organization that's still thriving. headquartered here in New York, but with operations all over the country, with a real commitment to raising awareness and sounding the alarm about autism, which back in 2005 really was very new. I mean, the disorder itself wasn't new, but the kind of work they were doing was. Still a lot of whispering about autism, a lot of parents were reluctant to talk about it openly with friends and neighbors and family, a lot of cultural barriers to access to care, and obviously the biggest problem being late diagnosis. There was just still not a lot known about autism. So the Wrights started that foundation, and I was introduced to Bob by a very close friend of mine who has a son on the spectrum, and he had been doing some volunteer work there. And he said, you've got to meet these guys, and they're doing great work, and Bob's looking to do some additional stuff. And so it's funny, my years at ABC News, which were brief, but Bob was running NBC at the time, and I'd always heard such remarkable things about him, and they all turned out to be true. I went to work for Bob at Autism Speaks and was the president for about 4 years, a little more.
Just as an outsider, Autism Speaks had just an incredible marketing job and communications job, public health communications job. It really just, it seemed to come out of nowhere, and then it was everywhere. And everybody knew Autism Speaks and caps off to that. And because autism was increasing so much, and everyone has knows someone who is involved with it somehow. And Autism Speaks just really became the player so quickly. So that's an amazing job that the organization did.
They did. And I'll tell you, there are a few secrets to their success. I would say the first one was that Bob and Suzanne were unapologetic about going around and leveraging every relationship they had, both in the media and in philanthropy and corporate America, to drive attention. So they've got donated media everywhere. They raised hundreds of millions of dollars themselves, and then the organization did. And they put together a crackerjack board of directors, mostly CEOs, who really approached the whole mission and enterprise as a business, with metrics and measuring how they were doing and how successful they were being, and holding everybody accountable who was involved. So that's how they approached their scientific research, and it's how they approach the advocacy and how they approach raising awareness. You know, one of the most important things they did right off the bat, and this was before I got there, was, you know, polling and interviewing parents of children with autism and asking them what would make the biggest difference in their lives, what would be the biggest help. And overwhelmingly, the parents responded that they needed insurance coverage for the treatments and the therapies that their kids required. Most of these, almost all of them, were not covered by private insurance. So here for years, these families have been paying into, you know, insurance premiums for other health coverage. But autism lives in the mental health space. It is actually a psychiatric diagnosis, and it was not covered. So state by state, Autism Speaks went out and built this massive grassroots army and took on the insurance companies in 50 states in the nation.
And that's what it takes, right?
And that's what it
takes.
Massive
efforts.
There is no shortcut to getting that kind of thing done.
And Autism Speaks led you to the Susan B. Wright Pancreatic Cancer Foundation. Am I saying that right?
It's a Suzanne Wright.
Yeah.
Suzanne Wright,
yeah.
While she was still serving as vice chairman at Autism Speaks, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer out of the blue. And Bob went on, while Suzanne was still alive, he asked me if I would take a look at the pancreatic cancer landscape, because he was stunned to learn that there were still no detection tests for pancreatic cancer, no curative treatments, 91% mortality rate. 50 years after Nixon declared the war on cancer, pancreatic cancer is still nowhere.
Yeah.
And for a guy as informed as Bob was, and had his own cancers, actually three different types of cancer, he was outraged, as he should be, and as other families are who've been affected by this, to see that the approach to diagnosis and treatment hasn't changed in all these years. That the NIH, year after year, is spending, you know, $180 million. Now it's up to about $200 million a year, approaching the same problem with the same failing approach. And even though there are tremendous doctors around the country, for, you know, premier medical institutions and committed people at the NIH, there's no way you're going to succeed. We know this is the law of everything. If you take the same approach every single year and you keep failing and expecting different results, you got to do something differently.
And that leads us really to what I wanted to talk to you about tonight, which is through the Susan Wright Pancreatic Cancer Foundation. You've been espousing what seems to me like an incredible idea, and the organization is espousing that, and getting some traction on both sides of the aisle in Washington. And could you talk to us a little bit about what HARPA is and where it came from? Because this is really interesting from a business perspective. It's amazing what can happen when you cut red tape, and I'll set it up with that.
So, well, I'll start at the end just with the HARPA and the acronym. It stands for Health Advanced Research Projects Agency, HARPA. It's really DARPA, which as many Americans or almost everyone is familiar with, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is really the greatest innovation arm, not only in the federal government, probably around the world, for national security and building technologies for national security. And it lives within the Department of Defense.
And for those who don't know about DARPA, I understand I did a quick look up. It was from, I guess, 1958. I guess Sputnik scared the heck out of Americans, and they thought, we have to get going. Could you walk those listening through exactly what DARPA is? And what makes it a big deal?
So DARPA was founded in 1958 by President Eisenhower, and some people say that it's actually his greatest legacy, that and the interstate highway system. But he established it after the Russians beat us into space, the Soviets beat us into space with Sputnik. And he looked around the Department of Defense and said, how is this possible? How come we haven't done this? And there were a lot of reasons why, but part of them were just, you know, it was classic government silos doing things, you know, a lot of institutional barriers to doing, you know, major innovative projects and approaches to things. So he set up an arm within the Department of Defense that is nothing to do with the rest of the federal bureaucracy. And the agency itself really established, and I'll just to shortcut for a second, some of their big, for people who are listening, their biggest accomplishments are GPS, night vision goggles, voice recognition technology, the internet.
You said mammograms too, right?
Well, mammographies, which I'll get to in a second when we talk about pancreatic cancer. But DARPA became the and remains the gold standard for innovation. You know, everything is about urgency and accountability and delivering results. And if you're going to fail, fail fast and move on. And they don't, it's not the typical government approach with grants out to different researchers and 10 years later waiting for results. Everything they do is on a contract basis with their vendors.
Is this both private and public sector?
Yes, and it's the federal investments do is stimulate the private sector to get engaged. Really, it was de-risk the marketplace for the private sector to engage to help accomplish federal government objectives. So in DARPA's case, it's for technologies for national security, but they have applications for consumer use. I mean, look at voice recognition technology is Siri. It's Alexa.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
I think you told me once that when the gyroscope on the phone that switches the screen from vertical to horizontal
it's a DARPA innovation. Yeah.
For pilots. Air Force pilots, right?
That's right.
Pretty interesting.
And on. There were so many other things that you and I use every single day, probably short of our can openers, that were DARPA inventions initially. The capability is a DARPA invention, and then the application becomes wider use. So in other words, they'll develop the capability.
And what is DARPA do about like red tape? Like you said, it's not typical government where it's a grant here, a grant there. Does it actually knock down barriers?
Yeah. So the way the ecosystem works, DARPA is a federal agency that has other federal agencies at its disposal, essentially the assets and resources of other federal agencies, and then also the private sector, biotech companies, venture philanthropy, academic institutions, but within the federal government, it's NIH, the FDA, the VA, any other agency that has an asset that DARPA thinks needs to be brought to bear to solve a problem, the barriers go down, the silos are erased, and the DARPA director or the program manager in charge of a specific project has access to.
Will DARPA move private sector employees and public sector employees into the same lab, basically? Will they put them together to work together?
Yeah, the program manager within DARPA who's running a project, let's say the guy who is running this voice recognition technology project, he has the authority and the budget, which is critically important here. These projects are funded appropriately so that they can succeed, to go out and bring to bear anybody he needs, an electrical engineer, a neuroscientist, a biotech guy, a philanthropist, and bring them all together and run it like it's like a campaign. And there are milestones for every project. And if you don't meet the milestones, the project can be cut off. It's, as I said, very different from a typical government granting agency. And really interestingly, the program managers who work at DARPA, The day they're hired, they come in and they have a date of departure right on their ID tags. So they know they're playing beat the clock with whatever project that they're, you know, with whatever passion project they're working on. So there's this, none of this sense that you might be around for 20 years and you're going to get the gold watch at the end and they'll give you a party. You come in, you focus, there's accountability, there's urgency, and then you deliver results.
And you invent voice recognition.
And you do big things.
Right. And I'm desperately trying not to say Siri or Alexa so that listeners don't have their devices go off. I live on Alexa. I guess I can thank DARPA. So, okay, so you have DARPA.
So we have DARPA. And there's no such thing as HARPA. There is no vehicle in the federal government right now to innovate for health the way DARPA does for national security.
Did the Pancreatic Cancer Research Foundation, did that lead you to come up with HARPA, the idea of it?
Yeah, I'll tell you how that happened. So Suzanne Wright had died. It was very late in 2016. And Bob Wright and I started going door to door on Capitol Hill to advocate for getting a pilot project for pancreatic cancer, to take it out, because it's failing so miserably with the current approach, take it out of the granting structure and get special funding and try it a very different way, a whole different approach. So we went door to door on the Hill. And as we were having our conversations on the Hill, a number of members of Congress and their staff said to us, you ought to do this project through DARPA. They do the most amazing work. DARPA is really the place to go. And we found out that there are a lot of things that are being done through DARPA that really should be done somewhere else, but there's no other vehicle to do it. And DARPA has all the principles of success, right? And it's particularly for a business guy like Bob, right? That makes so much sense for something like pancreatic cancer. So we went and met with Senator McCain's staff, and this before he was diagnosed with glioblastoma.
Before.
And they said, you know, Senator McCain doesn't want to keep putting more money for cancer research into DARPA. You should look at something else. And at the very same time, we met with Senator Markey's office, Ed Markey's office. And Ed Markey's wife was instrumental to over 25 years ago in getting mammogram technology discovered through DARPA. Susan Blumenthal, she's brilliant. And at the time,
she was in the
Surgeon General's office, if I remember this correctly. And she realized that there was CIA mapping technology that was so sophisticated that could be brought to map your internal organs, basically. So yeah. She went and got all of these guys at DARPA to help and design what has become the most revolutionary mammogram technology out there. So Ed Markey, we saw Ed, Senator Markey, who was
from Massachusetts,
tremendous
right?
help yep. to us, and met with his wife, Susan Blumenthal, and she said, this is what you should be doing. So between hearing that DARPA had actually done that kind of technology, and hearing from other folks, well, don't keep shoving it into DARPA. There's enough need to set up something else. So there were about 9,000 known human diseases. And this is a stunning statistic. There are curative treatments or therapies for approximately 500 of them.
Wow.
500. And the saddest part of all, or the most tragic part, is that there aren't people working on any of these other diseases in many cases. In some cases, there are. But there are so many rare diseases out there that just don't have any attention at all. No funding.
There's no profit.
No prioritization. Margin, yeah. There's no profit. So really what we found out, Bob and I were introduced to Jeff Ling, who was the founder of the biotech division of DARPA. He's a national treasure is what he is. And he is currently at Johns Hopkins. He's a professor of neurology, and he runs the neurocritical care unit. And we talked to him about what we should do. He's the one who got us going with HARPA. He and someone from the Obama administration, Mike Stebbins, who had worked in the White House there, and said that they used to talk around setting up something like a HARPA, but no one had really defined it that way. And what became abundantly clear was that, yeah, pancreatic cancer is our priority, but there were a lot of other diseases that just haven't benefited from the current system. And one of the big reasons that progress hasn't been made in the private sector is it's too risky. We needed to find a way to de-risk the marketplace.
Yep.
And the best way to do it is exactly what DARPA has done. Big federal investment with a lot of accountability to drive the private sector to get engaged. And there's no question about it. And you and I have spent many hours over the course of our friendship over the last 40 years railing about the federal government. But there is a role for the federal government. And in this case, the federal government would actually be the biggest financial beneficiary, because the money that would be saved on treatments over the years for all these diseases, you know, the CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, pay billions of dollars for diseases that we should be detecting earlier and preventing or treating and curing.
So, and this wouldn't affect NIH or FDA or current agencies. They would work together as with DARPA. So they would their research would still go on?
Well, not only would it go on, it's necessary. It's absolutely, HARPA could never happen without it. The NIH has a trove of clinical assets that could never be replicated in the private sector, plus the intellectual knowledge. And the same is true with the National Science Foundation, and there's the FDA. The private sector couldn't do this on its own. It could do some stuff on its own, but it's the combination of the public-private ecosystem that would make HARPA as effective as DARPA. That's the secret sauce here. Yeah. The leadership coming from the federal government with the NIH at the table, but being led with a different set of operating principles.
Obvious question. Why wouldn't we do this?
Right. And how is this for an obvious answer? Institutional barriers to progress. We don't do it this way. Territorialism within the federal government.
You're making progress, though.
Well, we've got overwhelming bipartisan support on the Hill for it. But there was, initially questions about how much is it going to cost, and we don't need another federal agency. But, if you just look at this straight down, never mind the lives that would be saved, but as a business equation, we have the NIH as an under-leveraged asset, is what it is. There are resources and there's research that's sitting on the shelf at the NIH that's not reaching patients, it's not reaching families, it's not reaching people who, are living with these incurable diseases. And it's not enough just to understand the biology of disease. You got to do something about it. And it's not in the NIH's mission to do the kind of work that HARPA would do. And that's why, we can't spend $37 billion a year just to understand disease. We've got to be able to do more than that. So we look at this really from that standpoint as a business investment. It's not even a close call. You could take 2%, 5% max of the kind of budget that overall that the NIH has and make a huge difference by doing this.
You could move the research forward. I mean, just light years, it sounds like.
Light years. Yeah. And we've already built a stable of private sector support here, biotech firms, venture philanthropy, academic institutions who want to do this.
Yeah.
So we've been engaged in a bit of a two-step, let's call it, with some members of the administration. But the White House has been, up until now, supportive, but we haven't been able to get it over the finish line.
Right. What should people do? If anybody's listening and they care about medical innovation, which I think we all do,
yeah.
What do you do? How do you weigh in on this and make some noise?
You know what? You can come to the SuzanneWrightFoundation.org, which is our website.
Yep.
You can certainly call the White House. I mean, this agency would live within HHS, Health and Human Services Department, just like DARPA lives within the DOD, but it'd be its own line of authority, as I said. But we need the White House to give it the green light, and then it will need congressional authorization because that's the process for, and then an appropriation.
And this would be, it could be a great victory for everybody in Washington. You could actually have a bipartisan, like a really substantive win.
Huge. It is DARPA for medical breakthroughs. And the support from the patient groups, the patient advocacy groups, there are no losers in this mix. There really aren't. I would tell you, well, here's the downside. There is no downside. And what's happening now, there are millions of patients living every single day with no promise of a cure or even a therapeutic treatment. And given how far we've come on so many other issues, the 21st century tools and technologies that are available to us that aren't being used, it's a crime when it comes to health stuff. They're being used for so many other things. Look at your new iPhone. Do you have the 11 over there? No. They're not being used enough to save lives. And that's what HARPA would do.
Can you hit me with the website again just so people know?
Sure. It's the SuzanneWrightFoundation.org.
The Suzanne
or HARPA.
Wright.
Or HARPA.org.
Or HARPA.org. Yeah. H-A-R-P-A.
Even Google HARPA. Yep. You look it up.
By the way, you're listening to Mind Your Business on Talk Radio 77 WABC. I'm speaking with Liz Feld about a number of topics. There's something else you're working on too, which I thought people might want to hear about because of there's a lot of tragedy in America right now on a lot of fronts, personal tragedies. Could you talk a little bit about Radical Hope that
yes.
you're helping with as well?
Thank you. So another remarkable United States business leader, Larry Bossidy, lost a grandson to suicide about 2 years ago. And his daughter, Pam Martin, whose son it was, set up a foundation with her husband called Radical Hope in her son's honor, Chris Martin, to focus on the emotional and brain health of our young people. Suicide is an epidemic, and people throw that term around a lot, but the suicide rates in this country are staggering. They're higher than they've been since World War II. And there's been a lot of coverage on that, but I think when you look particularly at the escalating numbers in the teenage year, you know, between, you know, sort of 18 to 25 year olds, it's terrifying, really. So the Family Foundation, Radical Hope, is really focused on trying to evaluate what mental health programs that are out there are successful but might need operational or evidentiary support, and how we could scale them to make them more accessible. Because there just aren't enough resources available right now. You can't put a psychiatrist in every town or in every high school or in every elementary school. But what kinds of programs are out there, even if they're not clinical, but they have therapeutic benefits,
yeah,
that we know help people connect? Because at the root of so much of what we know about suicide is this desperate emotional and social isolation. And we talk about this about our culture all the time now, even independent of the conversation about suicide, is how are we going to get people better connected to each other in their communities?
Do you think that's, I mean, it's an obvious question, but do you think that's made worse by our addiction to these square things in front of us, the phones, where you're communicating with other people, but you're really not making a human connection? It's different.
Well, and the evidence supports exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
That it's we're actually more isolated than ever. One of our challenges and one of the opportunities for all of us who are looking at this is, you know, how we can actually turn social, not just the social media like Facebook or, Snapchat or whatever, into, you know, forces for good, but how can we meet people where they are and actually use technology to help them? Because we are not going to change the way people are using their phones right now. And that's not our mission. And that's a whole other, you know, that's every
right.
parent in America. That's not, you know, we're all guilty of that. But what can we do? How are we going to do?
The Luddites lost, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you're not, you know, I'm the one of those. So, you know, but how can we maybe at least connect people to resources through technology?
Yeah.
But really what we're trying to do, as I said, is find programs. There are a lot of programs that seem like they're effective, but they actually haven't been evaluated. They call themselves evidence-based, but they aren't necessarily. So we are, you know, back to sticking to the business lane here. We are figuring out, you know, an evaluation process to go in and look at programs that seem like they're working, figure out if they are working, how we can help them scale to reach more people.
So Radical Hope, it's so interesting because so many new organizations that pop up want to do everything themselves. And it sounds like Radical Hope is actually looking to discern what's working and what's not. Like, I mean, you're basically giving a imprimatur of good, you know, good standing for investors, right? You want to get people to give money where programs are actually working and aren't just a lot of fluff.
There's no question about that. And when we first started working on this about a year ago, a little more than that, several of us did a sort of a snapshot of the landscape out there, the program landscape and the research landscape in mental health, youth mental health more specifically. And, you know, the good news was there was actually a lot of really good work being done, and there's fantastic research that's available. It's just not getting to the people who need it. This is not different from the HARPA situation and these other, you know, great stuff sitting on a shelf. Why isn't it getting to the people, you know, who need it on the ground? So we figured the best value or contribution we could make to the field was to raise money and donate money, the family itself has, to support the things that are working, validate them, make sure they're working, make sure that operationally that they're viable and sustainable, because sustainability is a huge challenge for a lot of these behavioral programs.
Yeah.
A huge problem. And then get behind them and really help them go.
Yeah, you help them scale so they can be available, I mean, theoretically, in every town in America.
Right. And if not that specific program,
something like it.
So our first investment has been this wonderful expressive arts program called Peace Love, which is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, although they are all over the country. And it's just a series of workshops that are run there about an hour each, content. And we all know the value of expressive arts, just being able to communicate your feelings and doing it on a piece of paper with a pen or a paintbrush. And what's been a great eye-opener is to confirm what we had thought and knew anecdotally, which is that the content and the whole idea of storytelling works across every population and every demographic. Whether you're incarcerated, whether you're a senior citizen or a 5-year-old in a trauma unit in a hospital, just being able to let it all out on a piece of paper is extraordinarily valuable. So peace love might not be able to be everywhere all over the world, but the idea of expressive arts is effective. So we're looking at things like that.
Yeah.
Youth sports, we know, is another spectacular sports work,
like cooking 4-H clubs, right?
Nature programs. Yeah. So yes, that's
kind of plugging
into
your community.
And part of this, and I'm so glad you reminded me of this, is really there are things right now in your own backyard, in your own neighborhood, in your own street that can really help you feel more connected. We all feel isolated at times. Yeah. This is not all about getting one-on-one therapy or one-on-one treatment. There's a place for that, but there are so many other ways we can be better connected. Like you said, put down your phone.
Put down the phone, right. And start thinking locally. Local is better, right? Sometimes, right.
Well, have you seen this with campaigns? You know, all the campaigns you've been working on over the last 10 years.
Yep.
What's the meet and greet process these days?
It's all totally changed. I have a company, I'm a partner at a company called the November Team, and we do a lot of political communications and campaigns, and it's a different animal. Politics is no longer really a persuasion endeavor. It's a marketing endeavor. It's now just slice and dice the audiences and stick the meme in front of their faces and duplicate it a lot of time and hope for a result. Where when I came into politics and when you came into politics, you were trying to win minds and hearts. And that's the kind of politics I like, where you can actually persuade people to change their mind on things or to lead and have them follow if they're not on something yet. And that's not what politics is today.
Well, so what I love about the Iowa caucuses is that people actually still convene. There is that power of convening where a candidate has to go in a room and 30 people, in some cases it's 5 people in a barn, in some cases it's 500. They actually come together and talk and hear that they're not just online on Twitter saying nasty things about each other or getting their having one-sided conversations.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. But I don't know how common it is anymore in other parts of the country during the electoral process.
But there's also a counter movement going on of people who are getting increasingly involved locally. And this is my great hope for the country is that, and I've tried to do it myself and join, you know, the library board and help out at school here and there and do some volunteer stuff, where everything is so Washington focused and we get up in the morning and we look at, you know, what's going on at the White House or that type of thing. Or if we, you know, we're walking down 57th Street and we stumble in a pothole and fall down, we want to create a federal law to ban potholes. Like everything, we keep wanting to farm it out as far up as possible.
And blame someone else.
And blame somebody and send it up. And there's so much to be said, you know, about local government, local activity. You know, locally people can get, they can find agreement. There's less partisanship locally. I mean, there's some fighting here and there, but you can actually, it's individual human beings talking with one another, and they'll work out solutions. They'll find them. And because they have to, because you have
they're
to.
They're sharing space.
You have to
they're
fill that
literally
pothole.
Living cheek by jowl, sharing community space.
So I've seen just anecdotally a movement towards people getting involved more locally and towards a more federalist thinking. It's not, I think we need a more federalist system again, but more federalist thinking where, you know, if you need to fix it, you fix it locally. If it can't be done locally, maybe you check your county. If it can't be done by the county, maybe the state. And then as a last resort, you kick it up to Washington. But mostly you try and get things done face-to-face in the town hall. And it creates a stronger country. It creates strong communities. It creates, I mean, that's the way we used to be. And so, you know, there's my diatribe. That's But I think there's great hope in localism for this country, and I hope it continues to spread.
Well, it is the original and ultimate place for connection. It's why people moved to small communities in suburbia, you know, 100 years ago.
That's right. Yeah,
it was to feel more connected and to not be anonymous.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One thing that I'm working on, which is just the opposite, which is I'm going to ask people to listen to this story and maybe get involved with their phones and with their computers, because this does matter, and Liz is looking at my shirt.
I am.
Right now.
So Billy's got a button on right now that says hashtag free Marcia, and I've been dying to ask him about it, so now I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah,
so who's Marcia and why does she need to be freed?
And Liz, you know me well, and you know that I'm not somebody who wears ribbons. I'm like Kramer, yep. No ribbon, you know, you're not wearing the ribbon. I'm not really a button-wearing guy. Even for campaigns that I work on, I don't wear buttons, but this one I'm proudly wearing and emphatically wearing, because there is a situation going on that John Grisham could not capture more in a novel. And it's a very real and sad situation that as many Americans as possible need to know about. This involves a woman named Marcia Lazareva. And you can actually go to MarshaLazareva.com. Marsha is M-A-R-S-H-A. Lazareva, L-A-Z-A-R-E-V-A. And or you can go to on Twitter, you could do hashtag Free Marsha. Marsha Lazareva is a woman who grew up in Soviet Russia. And she, you know, with obviously very little opportunities in a totalitarian system, just incredibly bright, incredibly ambitious, and came to the U.S. and went to Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Excuse me. And Marsha became one of the foremost businesswomen in the world. She, her mother, she moved to Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Philadelphia, where her mother is from. She has a little boy named Ivan, and they're in Bryn Mawr. But Marsha was working in countries all over the world, like 32 nations, really crazy bright kind of investment world. And she was working in Kuwait and got unfairly accused of a crime and thrown into a squalid Kuwaiti prison where she spent 474 days. She was accused of stealing hundreds of millions of dollars falsely. She went to Kuwait to face the court saying, what is this about? She was not allowed to present a defense, thrown into this crazy overcrowded prison. It's, I mean, it's infamous, where I think the cells are made for two people and they're seven or eight. After 474 days in this prison on a 10-year sentence, it was discovered that the evidence used to put her in jail was all forged. It was forgeries. And that the money that they said that she had taken was where it had always been. It was in a bank account. And so Kuwait then charged the person who did the forgery. He fled the country. That's a whole nother story. And so Marsha Lazareva was released, but she can't leave Kuwait, and she's got her 5-year-old son there. And she's afraid that at any time, they've taken her passport, she can't come back to the U.S. At any time, she's afraid they're going to grab her and throw her back into prison, and her 5-year-old boy is going to be stuck there. It's a horrible situation. It is really... there's a lot of ins and outs to this. There's lots of has been written on it, and you know, fortunately, a lot of good people have come forward to help publicize the Marsha Lazareva case and to get involved locally, including former FBI Director Louis Free is advocating for Marsha. Neil Bush, the son of George H.W. Bush, President Bush 41, and the brother of President Bush 43. And you should add that this Neil Bush's father led the effort to free Kuwait, which is worth mentioning, are all working to help Marsha. Pam Bondi, the former attorney general, or I know you know Liz, from Florida, is helping out. Amber Heard, the actress, spoke out at the UN last week at UNGA, the UN General Assembly. There are a lot of good people that are out there. One of Boris Yeltsin's daughters is involved. But it's just going to take a lot of people talking about it.
What's the government? What's the State Department doing?
The State Department. I mean, I think they're aware of it, and I don't know where it is. But she's still there. She's not allowed to come back. By the way, she's desperate to get Ivan baptized. They're Russian Orthodox, and she wants to get Ivan baptized in their family church in Philadelphia, St. Andrews. And the father there, the priest, has been very outspoken as well, as has the Philadelphia Council and clergy. There's a lot of outpouring going on, but it hasn't been fixed yet. The thought is that the Emir of Kuwait has a very good reputation. He's known as a really good guy and a true humanitarian. But the thinking is that maybe he's not getting the information that he needs. He's in America now. He had a little health issue, and I believe he's staying at his residence in New Jersey, but he may not be given the proper information here. But Louis Free from the FBI, who's internationally renowned, total straight shooter, looked at this case upwards and backwards and said, this is a setup. This is a frame job. It's intricate. There's another company involved that didn't get the contract, that's got friends in the Kuwaiti government that may have been involved in this. There's a lot of shifty stuff going on here. But if anyone is interested in getting involved to help a mother and her little boy who just turned 5 get home to Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, you can go to MarshaLazareva.com or go to hashtag Free Marsha on Twitter and follow what's going on, because it's a horrific situation. I know there's lots of human rights things that happen around the world and women's rights issues, but and you could choose from them, but this is one that really matters very deeply to me anyway, and to a lot of people. And so I hope people, will check in on it. And if they can, also, speak to members of Congress or do what you can.
I was going to ask you, what is the support you're getting from anyone on the Hill? And where's the media?
Bipartisan again.
Well, this strikes me as a 60 Minutes kind of story.
Yeah, there's been me as well. There's been the Washington Post has written on this, and the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Post had a great story. Alicia Maldonado had a story last week that was very good. The Washington Examiner had a piece done by Defensive Christians last week arguing for the Magnitsky Act, which is the act that can give can freeze money and et cetera, for bad actors around the world. So there are people speaking out about it, but it desperately needs as much attention as possible, because you've got, at the end of the day, it's a 46-year-old mom and a little boy stranded in Kuwait, and they can't get back to Pennsylvania. And so it definitely needs attention.
And can I ask one last question? How did you get involved with this?
Through a friend I had worked with before on a couple of other issues. He had heard about it, and he asked if I could help publicize it, and I said sure. And so I've been doing that, and I've done stuff in New York and Pennsylvania and Washington, and there's a whole big team out there. There's lots of people that are trying to help, but it's a very loud world right now. There's
yes,
so many things going on that it's hard to focus people's attention on a story. But there is a little boy at stake here and his mother. So I appreciate the time to talk about it. You're listening to Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is Mind Your Business. We'll be back in a minute with a guest that is going counter to all things internet and digital. We will be right back.
Every accounting firm has a history. The history of Saul Friedman & Company spans 45 years of commitment, dependability, and reliability for our clients. A client of Saul Friedman & Company is never alone in making critical business decisions. Behind each business move stands the full resources of an accounting firm with the financial know-how to inspire confidence and ensure success. Call 718-232-1111 now to find out how Saul Friedman & Company can help you grow your business. There's a reason our tagline is accounting with accountability. That is what we believe in, and that is the ethic we follow. For a free consultation, call 718-232-1111. That's 718-232-1111. Or visit our website at snfco.com. That's snfco.com.
If you're installing hardwood or SPC or WPC vinyl flooring, do it with the highest quality products. PC Hardwood Floors, the hardwood flooring leader, has been supplying flooring professionals with the highest quality flooring materials for over 40 years. The knowledgeable team at PC Hardwood Floors will ensure that your materials will arrive at your job site by our own fleet trucks, hassle-free. With 7 locations in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and next-day delivery, PC Hardwood Floors is the tri-state area's preferred full-service hardwood flooring distributor. Call 866-369-3232 to find out how PC Hardwood Floors can help you find the right hardwood products and finishing supplies for all your flooring projects. For a free consultation, call 866-369-3232. That's 866-369-3232. Or visit us at pchardwoodfloors.com. That's pchardwoodfloors.com.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business on Talk Radio 77 WABC. I'm Bill O'Reilly. I'm here with Liz Feld. We're talking about lots of things today, about HARPA and DARPA and
Marcia.
And Marcia Lazareva. Exactly. So we thought we'd talk a little business, since it's a business show. We were hoping to feature one business about to start, one startup business, and we couldn't think of anything better than a business about to open called Blush Waters Design. And the reason we find this company so fascinating is that it's old school. We were just talking about the world spinning out of control digitally, and everything is electronic. And the guests that we're about to introduce you to, who are Jill Rizak and Brooke Russ, are breaking all barriers and going back to, of all things, paper. Welcome to Mind Your Business, Jill and Brooke. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, thank you so much for having us. We are doing phenomenal. How are you guys?
Oh, doing great. We tell us all about it. Tell us all about Blush Waters. We're very excited. When do you open? How do people find out about it? What do you do? We're completely into this.
We're in your demo.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
So we are so excited. We are due to open up actually on Monday of next week. And what we provide is a full service paper design company. We really focus on weddings, but also provide businesses business cards and graphic design services, from letterhead to stationery and everything in between.
Why paper? Shouldn't have to ask it, but why paper? Like in a world that's all email and text messaging and WhatsApp and Twitter and Instagram, why paper? Does it still matter?
You know what? I'm going to answer this one. It matters to me. We live in such a digital world, and I love the idea of us going back to the basics. And, you know, when I go get my mail, which is not that often because it's not that exciting, it's bills and little flyers, and occasionally I'll get a letter in the mail, and then I'm excited. So this is just kind of, for us, getting back to the basics and keeping it real and the personal touch.
Do you think that, like, does quality matter in this? I think it does a lot. You know, when, like, I've always wanted to have as good business cards as I can have, for example, or stationery. Like, there's some things you just don't scrimp on. And you're actually going to, I understand, design, like, you're not going to be showing people books of other people's stationery. You're actually designing the stationery, right, with the paper.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you think about when you meet somebody at a networking event or even with wedding stationery, that's your first introduction to that person and really the lasting impression when you have, you know, a 5-second, 10-minute conversation and you want to leave something with someone, you want it to be the best representation of yourself. And that's where we believe paper really comes into play. And that's where we think it's so important to have quality paper and quality business cards so that's almost your handshake. That's your, it was wonderful to meet you. Here's my card and remember me because I'm somebody you want to work with. I'm somebody you want to continue life with. And I think that it's a huge first impression. And, you know, it can, like I said, it can go from business cards or it can be a wedding, you know, and it's an introduction to an amazing event. And it's your first step through the door of saying, hey, come celebrate with us. And so to have it beautifully designed, to have it on beautiful paper, that's what inspires us and motivates us because it's something that gets people excited.
I heard somebody say recently that a wedding experience begins with the invitation, that you know what kind of wedding it's going to be and what the feel of it is by the invitation. I thought that was very interesting.
And it's so true. And it's our goal with our brides as clients is to have everybody open the invitation and say, whatever I have going on, it's not as important as this. And, you know, I'll do anything I can to make it to this event because I know it's going to be incredible. And it tells a story of the couple, and it's the first opportunity to tell that story. It's so inspiring, and it's such an honor to be able to work with brides and you know, families of the bride to make this statement piece.
You know, I have found that I think it shows a real level of respect when you send someone something of that kind of quality. In the same way, a handwritten note is so much more memorable. And I'm always struck by how many people, years after you've sent someone a note, will say, you know, it meant so much to me when you wrote X, mm-hmm. whether it was to acknowledge
right.
that someone's passing or a celebratory something or congratulations on your retirement. I don't think handwritten notes are a lost art at all. And I actually think more than ever, they were significant. They'd mean something. And I think stationery, you know, with your name on the top or even your corporate letterhead with a handwritten, you know, with handwritten note is so important. I don't think it's ever going to go out of style.
Absolutely.
I certainly hope not.
I agree. It seems irreplaceable. I remember years ago, I had a client and we were doing some PR work for the person. I came into my office the next day and there was a bottle of scotch waiting for me with a bow on it. And it was like, you never forget that kind of stuff. And a card has become that.
Right.
Because you're right.
Right.
It's so rare. Right. Like Jill, you talked about going through your mail. I can't throw my mail out fast enough. And every once in a while, you get a letter.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's to an actual letter.
Dear customer.
Right.
Yes.
It's not one made to look like
not
a letter. You get an actual letter, you know?
No. I'm curious what kind of research you had to do to make sure that there's a market still for this, because it thrills me to know that there's a way to make a good business out of this and actually to get people to come into the store, and also obviously to reach you on your website. And you can share what your website is before we hang up.
Yeah, absolutely. So both of us have worked in the industry with other employers that have done something similar. So we do know that people come through the door often in a similar area. So that's definitely where a lot of our research has come from. But if you even go on the internet and just Google wedding stationery, you see significant amounts of businesses pop up. But the problem with online resources is you don't know the quality of the paper. You don't know how many people have mailed that same exact stationery piece out. And that's really where we feel like the person-to-person interaction is so essential to the entire experience. And Jill is really the amazing graphic designer here. She has the face-to-face contact, and she can listen to a person's story and translate it to a beautiful piece of paper so seamlessly that it feels like Jill has known you for years.
Well, that's
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Brooke, that's exactly what caught my attention. I heard about the business opening. It's going to be in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I thought, do you go into the store and pick out the stationery and buy it? And the person said, no, it's not like that. You actually go and do a consultation for a couple of hours and talk about your life story and how'd you meet your spouse-to-be and the rest of it. Like, that's pretty amazing. That's very different than where the world is. And that's why I love this so much and wanted to talk about it.
Well, I also just love the process. When a bride or a person coming in for stationery or business cards, where we start. And, you know, I usually don't start with, like, what do you want? But I sit and I talk with them. I get to know them. I get to get a feeling of, like, what they like, what they don't like. And then after the consultation, I can't just sit at the computer and design something right away. I have to kind of think about it, and it kind of goes in the back of my brain. And I'm going to tell you something. This happens to me. I'm so lucky. So many times, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll see it. And I cannot wait to get on my computer and with my paper and just get it all out there. And what's fun about the whole process for me is that where we start, and then you take different roads, and then where you end up, just the whole process is just, I love it. I'm going to tell you something. I love what we do. You know, I feel so lucky to be part of this. It's just such a great thing.
I'm just so glad that it's not a lost art. And I wonder how many companies are there out there anymore like yours. I mean, yours sounds pretty unique. I remember years ago working in a business, and a client came in, and she had her own font, and I thought she was the coolest person in the world. She had someone design her own font, and it was like everything she did was in her font.
That
she
is pretty cool, Bill. I have to say.
Oh, she was so cool. She was an author, and I won't mention her name because I don't know if she would want me to talk about it. An author that was fairly big in New York, and everything she did was in this with font, and it was just really nice class act stuff.
That was her brand and her identity, and she went with it, you know?
So now how many, like, what are the paper options? Like, I don't know that much about it.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, talk to us.
There's
talk to
so
us.
Many great things out there. Sorry. I get really excited about all this because there's so many things out there. Right now, the handmade paper with the deckled edge is really hot. But, you know, everyone has their personal tastes. I always say to our clients, it's not my money to spend, but here's my recommendation. And for me, it always comes back to the paper. It's what we look at. It's what we feel. And, you know, I always say, you know, if it was my money, this is what I would spend it on. This other stuff, the bells and whistles, but the paper is the paper. And there's so many fun things going on right now with different colors and different edging and different borders, but also paper is also the envelope, you know, the thing that comes in the mail. And, you know, the white or the ivory envelope is really not, you know, the only thing out there. It's the colors everywhere, and, you know, with white ink and foils, and you can just have so much fun, and it can be what you want it to be.
Well, I want to add a little plug for you guys here, too, because I did this for my son a couple of years ago when he was just finishing up college. They're great. It's a great gift. Getting business cards printed for someone who's about to start either looking for a job or start his first job. Just to have personal business cards with a name and your address and your contact info.
Yeah.
And also, obviously, stationery, which is fabulous. Yeah. No cards, and I think they're so handsome. You do them particularly for young men, young boys, who won't go out and get that stuff on their own. That's not where they're going to spend $50 or $100.
It's a perfect gift. And I even go to stationery to write my own personal thank you notes, you know.
Right.
And I feel like it says something instead of getting a box card set of a thank you across the front from a personal stationery writing a really heartfelt thank you. I mean, I still get compliments from friends that, you know, I just wrote a thank you note of, hey, I'm so grateful you had me over to have a glass of wine and catch up. And they say, man, that just showed up and it just made me remember the beautiful conversation we had and the time that we had. And, you know, we rarely get to steal away these moments. I'm actually a new mom, so.
It's the real human touch.
But it is.
I think we're about to run out of time, so I just wanted to say, ask one more time, can you tell everybody the website that they can get in touch with you, where they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Our website is blushwaters.com, and you can also email us at hello@blushwaters.com.
Love the hello. Brooke Russin, Jill Rosette, thank you so much for being on Mind Your Business. Liz, it's been wonderful
thank
to have you,
for
you on
having
as a co-host.
Us.
And thanks to Yitzhak Soflis for letting me co-host this week. Be well, everybody. And Yitzhak will be back at the mic a week from tonight.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Soflis. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Soflis has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.